This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Munich by Robert Harris. Read for you by David Rintoul.
To Matilda. We should always be aware that what now lies in the past once lay in the future. F. W. Maitland, historian, 1850 to 1906. We ought to have gone to war in 1938. September 1938 would have been the most favourable date. Adolf Hitler, February 1945. Day 1. Chapter 1. Shortly before 1 o'clock, on the afternoon of Tuesday, September the 27th, 1938, Mr. Hugh Leggett, of His Majesty's Diplomatic Service, was shown to his table beside one of the floor-to-ceiling windows of the Ritz restaurant in London. He ordered a half-bottle of 1921 Dom Pérignon he could not afford, folded his copy of the Times to page 17, and began to read for the third time the speech that had been delivered the night before in Berlin's Sportpalast by Adolf Hitler. Herr Hitler's speech. Final word to Prague. Peace or war? Occasionally, Leggett glanced across the dining room to check the entrance. Perhaps it was his imagination, but it seemed that the guests and even the waiters moving back and forth across the carpet between the dusky pink upholstered chairs were unusually subdued. There was no laughter. Soundlessly, beyond the thick plate glass, 40 or 50 workmen, some stripped to the waist in the humid weather, were digging slit trenches in Green Park.
There should remain no doubt for the whole world at this time that it is not one man or one leader who speaks, but the whole German people. I know that in this hour the whole people, millions strong, agree with every one of my words. Heil!
He had listened to it on the BBC as it was delivered. Metallic, remorseless, threatening, self-pitying, boastful, impressive in its horrible way, it had been punctuated by the thumps of Hitler's hand pounding the podium and by the roar of 15,000 voices shouting their approval. The noise was inhuman, unearthly. It had seemed to well up from some black subterranean river and pour out of the loudspeaker.
I am grateful to Mr. Chamberlain for all his efforts, and I have assured him that the German people want nothing but peace. I have further assured him, and I emphasize it now, that when this problem is solved, Germany has no more territorial problems in Europe.
Leggett took out his fountain pen and underlined the passage, and then did the same with another, earlier reference to the Anglo-German naval agreement.
Such an agreement is only morally justified if both nations promise one another solemnly never to wage war against one another again. Germany has this will. Let us all hope that those who are of the same will gain the upper hand among the British people.
He put aside the paper and checked his pocket watch. It was characteristic of him not to carry the time on his wrist like most men of his age, but rather on the end of a chain. He was only 28, yet seemed older, his face pale, his manner grave, his suit dark. He had made the reservation a fortnight ago, before the crisis had blown up. Now he felt guilty. He would give her another 5 minutes, then he would have to leave. It was 1:15 when he glimpsed her reflection between the flowers and the wall of gilded mirrors. She was standing on the edge of the restaurant, practically on tiptoe, peering around blankly, her long white neck extended, her chin tilted upwards. She refused to wear glasses. He studied her for a few more moments, as if she were a stranger, and wondered what on earth he would make of her if she were not his wife.
A striking figure, that was the sort of thing people said of her. Not pretty exactly. No, but handsome. Pamela's what one calls a thoroughbred. Yes, tremendous breeding, and entirely out of poor Hugh's league.
This latter he had overheard at the party to celebrate their engagement. He raised his hand. He stood. Finally she noticed him, smiled and waved and moved towards him, cutting quickly between the tables in her tight skirt and tailored silk jacket, leaving a wake of turned heads. She kissed him firmly on the mouth. She was slightly out of breath. "Sorry, sorry, sorry. It doesn't matter. I only just arrived." Over the past 12 months, he had learned not to ask where she had been. As well as her handbag, she was carrying a small cardboard box. She placed it on the table in front of him and pulled off her gloves. "I thought we agreed no presents." He lifted the lid. A black rubber skull, a metal snout, and the vacant glassy eye sockets of a gas mask stared back up at him. He recoiled. "I took the children for a fitting. Apparently I'm to put theirs on first. That will test one's maternal devotion, don't you think?" She lit a cigarette. "Could I have a drink? I'm parched." He signalled to the waiter. "Only a half bottle? I have to work this afternoon." "Of course you do. I wasn't sure you'd even show." "I ought not to have done, to be honest. I tried to call, but you weren't at home." "Well, now you know where I was. A perfectly innocent explanation." She smiled and leaned towards him. They clinked glasses. "Happy anniversary, darling." In the park, the workmen swung their picks. She ordered quickly, without even looking at the menu. No starter, Dover sole off the bone, green salad. Leggett handed back his menu and said he'd have the same. He couldn't think about food, couldn't rid his mind of the image of his children wearing gas masks. John was 3, Diana 2. All that cautioning of them not to run too fast, to wrap up warm, not to suck on toys or crayons because you never knew where they might have been. He put the box under the table and pushed it out of sight with his foot. Were they very frightened? Of course not. They thought the whole thing was a game. You know, sometimes I feel exactly that. Even if you see the telegrams, it's difficult not to think it's all just some ghastly joke. A week ago, it looked as though it had all been fixed. Then Hitler changed his mind. What will happen now? Who can say? Possibly nothing. He felt he should try to sound optimistic. They're still talking in Berlin. At least they were when I left the office. And if they stop talking, when will it start? He showed her the headline in the Times and shrugged. I suppose tomorrow.
Really? As soon as that?
He says he'll cross the Czech border on Saturday. Our military experts reckon it will take him 3 days to get his tanks and artillery in position. That means he'll have to mobilize tomorrow. He tossed the paper back on the table and drank some champagne. It tasted like acid in his mouth. I tell you what, let's change the subject. From his jacket pocket he produced a ring box.
Oh, Hugh!
It will be too big, he warned her.
Oh, but it's charming.
She slipped the ring onto her finger, held up her hand, and turned it back and forth beneath the chandelier so that the blue stone glinted in the light.
You are a wonder. I thought we hadn't any money.
We haven't. It was my mother's. He had been afraid she might think him cheap, but to his surprise she reached a hand across the table and laid it tenderly on his.
You are sweet.
Her skin was cool. A slim forefinger stroked his wrist.
I wish we could take a room, he said suddenly, and stay in bed all afternoon. Forget about Hitler. Forget about the children. Well, why don't you see if you can arrange it? We're here. What's to stop us?
She held his gaze with her large grey-blue eyes, and he knew, with a sudden insight that caught him in the throat, that she was only saying it because she was confident it would never happen. Behind him, a man coughed politely.
Mr. Leggett?
Pamela took away her hand. He turned to find the maitre d', palms pressed together as in prayer, grave with self-importance.
Yes?
Number 10 Downing Street are on the line for you, sir.
He was careful to say it just loudly enough for the neighbouring tables to hear.
Hell!
Leggett stood and threw down his napkin. Will you excuse me? I'll have to take it.
I understand. You go and save the world.
She waved him on his way.
We can have lunch any time.
She started packing her things into her handbag.
Just give me a minute.
There was a pleading edge to his voice. We really have to talk.
Go.
He hovered for a moment, conscious of the nearby diners staring at him. "Do wait," he said. He put on what he hoped was a neutral expression and followed the maitre d' out of the restaurant and into the lobby. "I thought you'd like some privacy, sir." The maitre d' opened a door to a small office. On the desk was a telephone, the handset beside it. "Thank you." He picked up the receiver and waited until the door had closed before he spoke. "Leggett?"
"Sorry, Hugh."
He recognized the voice of Cecil Sires, one of his colleagues in the Prime Minister's private office.
"I'm afraid you're going to have to come back right away. It's about to get rather hectic. Cleveley is asking for you."
"Has something happened?" There was a hesitation at the other end. The private secretaries were told always to assume the operator was listening in.
"It looks as though the talking's over. Our man is flying home."
"Understood. I'm on my way." He replaced the receiver on its cradle. For a moment he stood paralyzed. Was this what history felt like? Germany would attack Czechoslovakia. France would declare war on Germany. Britain would support France. His children would wear gas masks. The diners at the Ritz would abandon their white linen tablecloths to crouch in slit trenches in Green Park. It was all too much to grasp. He opened the door and hurried back across the lobby into the restaurant, but such was the efficiency of the Ritz's staff, their table was already cleared. In Piccadilly, there was not a taxi to be had. He danced back and forth in the gutter, vainly waving his rolled-up paper at every passing cab. Finally he gave up, rounded the corner into St. James's Street, and set off down the hill. From time to time he glanced across the road in the hope he might see his wife. Where had she gone in such a hurry? If she was walking straight home to Westminster, this was the direction she would have to take. Best not to think of it. Best never to think of it. Already he was sweating in the unseasonable heat. Beneath his old-fashioned three-piece suit, he could feel his shirt sticking to his back. Yet the sky was dull, threatening a rain that somehow never came. And all along Pall Mall, behind the tall windows of the great London clubs, the Royal Automobile, the Reform, the Athenaeum, the chandeliers glittered in the humid gloom. He did not slacken his pace until he reached the top of the steps leading down from Carlton House Terrace to St. James's Park. Here he found his path blocked by a silent crowd of 20, watching what looked like a small airship rising slowly behind the Houses of Parliament. It ascended past the spire of Big Ben, an oddly beautiful sight, majestic, surreal. In the distance he could make out half a dozen others in the sky south of the Thames, tiny silver torpedoes, some already thousands of feet high. The man beside him murmured, "I suppose you could say the balloon's gone up." Leggett glanced at him. He remembered his father using exactly the same expression when he was home on leave during the Great War. He had to go back to France because the balloon had gone up. To his six-year-old ears, it had sounded as if he was going off to a party. It was the last time he had seen him. He edged his way around the spectators, trotted down the three wide flights of steps, across the Mall and into Horse Guards Road. And here, in the centre of the sandy expanse of the parade ground, in the half-hour since he left, something else had happened. A pair of anti-aircraft guns had appeared. Soldiers were unloading sandbags from a flatbed lorry, working quickly as if they feared the Luftwaffe might appear at any moment, passing them from hand to hand along a human chain. A half-built wall of sandbags surrounded a searchlight battery. A gunner furiously turned a wheel. One of the barrels swung around and elevated until it was almost perpendicular. Leggett took out a large white cotton handkerchief and wiped his face. It would not do to turn up red-faced and perspiring. If there was one sin that was frowned upon above all others in the private office, it was appearing to be in a flap. He climbed the steps into the narrow, shadowed, soot-blackened cutting of Downing Street. On the pavement, opposite number 10, a group of reporters turned their heads to follow his arrival. A photographer raised his camera, but when he saw it was no one of importance, he lowered it again. Leggett nodded to the policeman, who rapped once, hard, with the knocker. The door opened, as if of its own volition. He stepped inside. It was 4 months since he had been seconded from the Foreign Office to work in number 10, yet each time he felt the same sensation. as if he were entering some gentleman's club that was no longer fashionable. The black-and-white tiled lobby, the walls of Pompeian red, the brass lantern, the grandfather clock ticking its leisurely heartbeat, the cast-iron umbrella stand with its solitary black umbrella. Somewhere in the depths of the building a telephone rang. The doorkeeper wished Leggett a good afternoon and returned to his leather coachman's seat and his copy of the Evening Standard. In the wide passageway leading to the back of the building, Leggett paused and checked himself in the mirror. He straightened his tie and smoothed down his hair with both hands. He braced his shoulders, turned. Ahead of him was the cabinet room, its panelled door closed. To his left, the office used by Sir Horace Wilson, also closed. To his right, the corridor that led to the offices of the Prime Minister's private secretaries. The Georgian house exuded an air of imperturbable calm. Miss Watson, with whom he shared the smallest office, was bent over her desk, exactly as he had left her, walled in by piles of folders. Only the top of her grey head was visible. She had begun her career as a typist when Lord George was Prime Minister. He was said to have chased the Downing Street girls around the cabinet table. It was hard to imagine him chasing Miss Watson. Her responsibility was preparing answers for parliamentary questions. She peered at Leggett over her barricade of papers. "Cleveley has been in looking for you."
"Is he with the PM?"
"No, he's in his office. The PM's in the cabinet room with the big three." Leggett made a noise that was between a sigh and a groan. Halfway along the corridor, he stuck his head into Sire's office. "All right, Cecil, how much trouble am I in?" Sire swung round in his chair. He was a small man, 7 years Leggett's senior, constantly and irrepressibly and often irritatingly amused. He wore the same college tie as Leggett.
"I'm afraid you picked rather the wrong day for a romantic lunch, old fellow."
His voice dropped sympathetically.
"I hope she didn't take it badly."
Once, in a weak moment, Leggett had hinted to Sires of his difficulties at home. He had regretted it ever since.
"Not at all. Things are on an even keel."
"What happened in Berlin?"
"Apparently it degenerated into one of Herr Hitler's tirades." Sires pretended to strike the arm of his chair. "Ich werde die Tschechen zerschlagen."
"Oh, good grief.
I will smash the Czechs."
A military voice called along the corridor.
"Ah, Leggett, there you are."
Sires mouthed,
"Good luck."
Leggett stepped backwards and turned to confront the long moustached face of Osmond Summers Cleverly, universally known for reasons unexplained as Oscar. The Prime Minister's principal private secretary crooked a finger. Leggett followed him into his office.
"I must say I'm disappointed in you, Leggett, and more than a little surprised."
Cleverly was older than the rest of them, had been a soldier by profession before the war.
"Lunch at the Ritz in the middle of an international crisis? It may be the way things are done in the Foreign Office. It's not how we do them here."
"I apologize, sir. It won't happen again."
"You have no explanation?"
"It's my wedding anniversary. I couldn't get hold of my wife to cancel the table." Cleverly stared at him for a few seconds longer. He did not bother to hide his suspicions of these brilliant young men from the Treasury and the Foreign Office who had never served in uniform.
"There are times when one's family has to take a back seat. Now is such a time."
The principal private secretary sat behind his desk and switched on a lamp. This part of the house faced north across the Downing Street garden. The unpruned trees that screened it from Horse Guards Parade cast the ground floor in a perpetual twilight.
"Has Sires filled you in?"
"Yes, sir. I gather the talks have broken down."
"Hitler has announced his intention to mobilize at 2 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. I'm afraid all hell is about to break loose. Sir Horace should be back to report to the PM by 5. The PM will broadcast to the nation at 8. I'd like you to deal with the BBC. They are to set up their apparatus in the cabinet room."
"Yes, sir."
"There will have to be a full cabinet meeting at some stage, probably after the broadcast. Therefore, the BBC engineers will need to clear out quickly. The PM will also be seeing the Dominion High Commissioners. The Chief of Staff are due to arrive any minute. Take them into the PM as soon as they all get here. And I shall need you to take a note of the meeting so that the PM can brief the Cabinet."
"Yes, sir."
"Parliament is being recalled, as you know. He intends to make a statement to the House on the crisis tomorrow afternoon. Have all the relevant minutes and telegrams for the past 2 weeks arranged for him in chronological order.
Yes, sir.
I'm afraid you will probably have to stay overnight. The phantom of a smile played beneath Cleaverley's moustache. He reminded Leggett of a muscular Christian games master at a minor public school.
It's a pity it's your anniversary, but it can't be helped. I'm sure your wife will understand. You can sleep in the duty clerk's room on the third floor.
Is that all?
That is all, for now.
Cleaverley put on his spectacles and began studying a document. Leggett walked back to his office and sat down heavily at his desk. He opened a drawer, took out a pot of ink, and dipped in his pen. He was not used to being reprimanded. Damn Cleaverley, he thought. His hand shook slightly, rattling his nib against the glass edge of the pot. Miss Watson sighed, but did not look up. He reached into the wire basket on the left of his desk and took out a folder of telegrams recently arrived from the Foreign Office. Before he could untie the pink ribbon, Sergeant Wren, the Downing Street messenger, appeared in the doorway. As usual, he was out of breath. He had lost a leg in the war.
The chief of the Imperial General Staff is here, sir.
Leggett followed him as he limped down the passage towards the lobby. In the distance, under the brass lantern, stood Viscount Gort, reading a telegram, his polished brown boots planted wide apart. A glamorous figure, an aristocrat, a war hero, a holder of the Victoria Cross, Gort seemed oblivious to the clerks and secretaries and typists who had suddenly discovered pressing reasons to cross the lobby in order to catch a glimpse of him. The front door opened on a cascade of flashes from the photographer's cameras, out of which stepped Air Marshal Newell, followed seconds later by the towering figure of the First Sea Lord, Admiral Backhouse. Leggett said, "If you would kindly come with me, gentlemen." As he led them into the interior, he heard Gort say,
"Is Duff coming?"
And Backhouse reply,
"No, the PM thinks he leaks to Winston."
"Would you mind waiting here for a moment?" The cabinet room was soundproofed by double doors. He opened the outer and knocked gently on the inner. The Prime Minister was seated with his back to the door. Facing him across the centre of the long table were Halifax, the Foreign Secretary, Simon, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, and the Home Secretary, Hoare. All three looked up to see who had come in. The room was in absolute silence, apart from the ticking of the clock. Leggett said, "Excuse me, Prime Minister. The Chiefs of Staff are here." Chamberlain did not turn. His hands were on the table, spread wide on either side of him, as if he were about to push back his chair. His forefingers slowly tapped the polished surface. Eventually, in his precise, slightly old maidish voice, he said,
"Very well. Let us meet again when Horace returns. We'll hear what more he has to say then."
The ministers gathered up their papers, awkwardly in the case of Halifax, whose withered left arm hung uselessly at his side, and rose to their feet without saying a word. They were men in their 50s or 60s, the big three in the prime of their power, bulked by their dignity beyond their physical size. Leggett stood aside to let them pass. "Like a trio of pallbearers in search of their coffin," was how he described them afterwards to Sires. He heard them greet the service chiefs waiting outside, hushed, grim voices. He said quietly, "Would you like me to show in the Chiefs of Staff now, Prime Minister?" Still, Chamberlain did not turn to look at him. He was staring at the opposite wall. His corvine profile was hard, stubborn, belligerent even. Eventually he said distractedly,
"Yes, of course. Yes, bring them in."
Leggett stationed himself at the far end of the cabinet table, close to the Doric pillars that supported the ceiling.
The bookcases showed the spines of brown leather-bound statutes and silvery blue editions of Hansard. The Chiefs of Staff placed their caps on the side table by the door and took the seats vacated by the ministers. Gort, as the senior officer, occupied the central position. They opened their briefcases and spread out their papers. All three lit cigarettes. Leggett glanced across at the mantel clock above the fireplace behind the Prime Minister's head. He dipped his nib into the nearby inkstand. On a foolscap sheet he wrote, "PM and COS, 2:05 PM. Chamberlain cleared his throat.
"Well, gentlemen, I'm afraid the situation has deteriorated. We had hoped,
and the Czech government had agreed to the orderly transfer of the Sudeten territory to Germany, subject to a plebiscite. Unfortunately, Herr Hitler announced last night he was not prepared to wait even so much as a week longer, and will invade on Saturday. Sir Horace Wilson saw him this morning, and warned him very firmly that if France fulfills her treaty obligations to Czechoslovakia, which we still have every reason to believe she will, then we shall be obliged to support France. The Prime Minister put on his spectacles and picked up a telegram. After his customary ranting and raving, Hitler responded, according to our ambassador in Berlin, in the following terms. If France and England strike, let them do so. It is a matter of complete indifference to me. I am prepared for every eventuality. I can only take note of the position. It is Tuesday today, and by next Monday we shall all be at war. Chamberlain put down the telegram and took a sip of water. Leggett's pen ran rapidly across the heavy paper. PM, latest from Berlin, breakdown of talks, violent reaction by Herr Hitler. Next week we will be at war. I shall, of course, continue my efforts to find a peaceful solution, if one exists, although it's hard at the moment to see what more can be done. But in the meantime, I fear we must prepare for the worst. Gort looked at each of his colleagues. Prime Minister, we have prepared a memorandum. It summarizes our collective view of the military situation. Perhaps I might read out our conclusion? Chamberlain nodded. It is our opinion that no pressure that Great Britain and France can bring to bear, either by sea, on land, or in air, could prevent Germany from overrunning Bohemia and from inflicting a decisive defeat on Czechoslovakia. The restoration of Czechoslovakia's lost integrity could only be achieved by the defeat of Germany and as the outcome of a prolonged struggle, which from the outset must assume the character of an unlimited war. Nobody spoke. Leggett was acutely conscious of the scratching of his nib. Suddenly it sounded absurdly loud. Eventually Chamberlain said, "This is the nightmare I have always dreaded. It's as if we've learnt nothing from the last war, and we're reliving August 1914. One by one, the countries of the world will be dragged in. And for what? We've already told the Czechs that once we've won, their nation in its present form cannot continue to exist. The 3.5 million Sudeten Germans must have the right of self-determination. Therefore, the separation of the Sudetenland from Germany will not even be an Allied war aim. So for what would we be fighting?"
"For the rule of law," suggested Gort.
"For the rule of law, indeed. And if it comes to it, we shall. But by God, I wish we could find some other way of upholding it."
The Prime Minister briefly touched his hand to his forehead. His old-fashioned winged collar drew attention to his sinewy neck. His face was grey with exhaustion, but with an effort he recovered his usual businesslike manner.
"What practical steps now need to be taken?"
Gort said, "We shall send 2 divisions to France immediately, as we have already agreed, to demonstrate our solidarity. They can be in position within 3 weeks, and in a position to fight 18 days after that. But General Gamelin has made it quite clear the French have no intention of mounting anything more than token raids on Germany until next summer. Frankly, I doubt they'll even do that. They'll stay behind the Maginot Line."
Newell added, "They're waiting until we arrive in greater strength." "And is the Air Force ready?"
Newell was sitting up very straight, a thin-faced man, skeletal almost, with a small grey moustache.
"I have to say this comes at the worst possible time for us, Prime Minister. On paper, we have 26 squadrons available for home defence, but only 6 have modern aircraft. 1 has Spitfires, the other 5 have Hurricanes."
"But they're ready to fight."
"Some are."
"Some?"
"I'm afraid there's a technical problem with the guns on the Hurricanes, Prime Minister. They freeze above 15,000 feet.
"What's that you're saying?" Chamberlain leaned forwards as if he had not heard correctly.
"We're working on a solution, but it may take some time."
"No, what you're actually saying, Air Marshal, is that we've spent £1,500 million on rearmament, the bulk of it on the air, and when it comes to it, our warplanes don't work." Our planning has always been predicated on there being no conflict with Germany before 1939 at the earliest. The Prime Minister turned his attention back to the Chief of the Imperial General Staff. Lord Gort, can't the army shoot down most of the attacking aircraft from the ground?
I'm afraid we are in a similar position to the Air Chief Marshal, Prime Minister. We only have about a third of the number of guns we believe are necessary to defend London, and most of those are obsolete relics from the last war. We're equally short of searchlights. We have no ranging or communication equipment. We were also counting on another year to prepare.
Halfway through his answer, Chamberlain seemed to have stopped listening. He had put on his spectacles again and was sorting through his papers. The atmosphere in the room had become uncomfortable. Leggett continued writing calmly, smoothing the awkward facts into bureaucratic prose. PM expressed concern at adequacy of home air defence, but the orderly mechanism of his mind was disturbed. Once again, he couldn't rid his mind of the image of his children in gas masks. Chamberlain had found what he was looking for.
The Joint Intelligence Committee estimates there will be 150,000 casualties in London by the end of the first week of bombing, 600,000 by the end of 2 months.
That's unlikely to happen immediately. We assume that to begin with, the Germans will direct their principal bombing force against the Czechs.
And when the Czechs have been defeated?
Then what?
Then we don't know. We should certainly use the time available to take precautions and start evacuating London tomorrow.
And how prepared is the Navy?
The First Sea Lord was a striking presence, a good head taller than anyone else in the room. His grizzled skull was bald, his face deeply scarred, as if he had been exposed to the elements too long.
We have some shortages of escort vessels and minesweepers. Our capital ships require fueling and arming. Some of the crews are on leave. We shall need to announce mobilization as quickly as possible.
When would you need to do that, to be operational by the 1st of October?
Today.
Chamberlain sat back in his chair. His forefingers tapped the table.
Of course, that would mean we would mobilize before the Germans.
Partially mobilized, Prime Minister.
And there is something else to be said for it. It would have the effect of showing Hitler we aren't bluffing, that if it comes to it, we are prepared to fight. It might even make him think twice.
It might. Or it might push him into war. Remember, I have stared into that man's eyes on two occasions now, and in my judgment, if there is one thing he cannot tolerate, it is losing face.
But surely, if we're going to fight, it's important he should be left in no doubt of that fact. It would be a tragedy if he interpreted your courageous visits and your sincere efforts for peace as a sign of weakness. Wasn't that the mistake the Germans made in 1914? They thought we weren't serious.
Chamberlain folded his arms and stared at the table. Leggett couldn't tell whether the gesture meant he had rejected the suggestion or was considering it. Shrewd of Backhouse to flatter him, he thought. The PM had few obvious weaknesses, but strangely for such a shy man, his besetting vice was vanity. The seconds ticked by. Finally, he looked up at Backhouse and nodded.
Very well.
Mobilize.
The First Sea Lord stubbed out his cigarette and stuffed his papers into his briefcase. I'd better get back to the Admiralty. The others rose with him, grateful to escape. Chamberlain called up to them. I would like you to hold yourselves in readiness to brief senior ministers later today. In the meantime, we should avoid doing or saying anything that contributes to a mood of public panic, or forces Hitler into a position from which he cannot back down, even at the 11th hour. After the chiefs of staff had gone, Chamberlain let out a long sigh and rested his head in his hand. Glancing sideways, he seemed to notice Leggett for the first time.
Were you making a note of all that?
Yes, Prime Minister. Destroy it.
Chapter 2.
In Wilhelmstrasse, in the heart of the government sector of Berlin, in the sprawling three-story 19th-century building that housed the German Foreign Ministry, Paul von Hartmann was contemplating a telegram that had come in overnight from London.
Confidential. London, 26 September 1938.
In the name of our old friendship and our common desire for peace between our peoples, I do urge Your Excellency to use your influence to postpone the decisive movement of October 1st to a later date. That time may be given to allay present passions and provide opportunities for reaching adjustment of details. Rothermere, 14 Stratton House, Piccadilly, London. Hartmann lit a cigarette and considered what sort of response was required. In the 7 months since Ribbentrop had taken over as foreign minister, he had been called upon many times to translate incoming messages from English into German, and then to draft replies in the minister's name. At first he had adopted the traditional, formal, neutral turn of a professional diplomat, but many of these early efforts had been rejected as insufficiently National Socialist. Some had even been returned to him by SS Sturmbannführer Sauer of Ribbentrop's staff, with a thick black line scrawled through them. He had been forced to recognise that if his career was to prosper, a certain adjustment of style would be necessary. Gradually, therefore, he had trained himself to mimic the minister's bombastic manner and radical worldview, and it was in this spirit that he set to work answering the owner of the Daily Mail, his pen scraping and stabbing at the paper as he worked himself into a state of faux outrage. His concluding paragraph in particular struck him as masterly. The idea that because of the Sudeten problem, which is completely secondary to England, peace might be destroyed between our two peoples seems to me madness and a crime against humanity. Germany has pursued an honest policy of understanding with England. It desires peace and friendship with England, but when foreign Bolshevist influences have come to the fore in English politics, Germany must be prepared for every eventuality. The responsibility before the world for such a crime would not fall to Germany, as you, my dear Lord Rothermere, know better than anyone. He blew on the ink. Really, with Ribbentrop one could not lay it on too thick. Hartmann lit another cigarette. He started again from the beginning, making small corrections here and there, squinting at the paper through his smoke. His eyes were a striking shade of violet and slightly hooded. His forehead was high. His hairline, even at the age of 29, had already receded almost to his crown. His mouth was wide and voluptuous, his nose strong. It was a mobile and expressive face, compelling, unusual, almost ugly. And yet his genius was for making men and women love him. He was about to place his draft in the basket to be sent to the typists when he heard a noise. Or perhaps it would be more accurate to say that he felt a noise. It seemed to travel through the soles of his shoes and up the legs of his chair. The pages in his hands shook. The rumble intensified, became a roar, and for a ludicrous moment he wondered if the city was experiencing an earthquake. But then his ear picked out the distinctive note of heavy engines revving and the clank of metal tracks. The two men with whom he shared the office, von Nostitz and von Franzau, glanced at one another and frowned. They got to their feet and went over to the window. Hartmann joined them. A column of drab, olive-green armoured vehicles was trundling south down Wilhelmstrasse from the direction of the Unter den Linden, artillery half-tracks, panzers on the backs of tank transporters, heavy guns towed by trucks and by teams of horses. Hartmann craned his neck. It went on for as far as he could see, a full motorised division to judge by the length of it. Von Nostitz, who was older than Hartmann and one grade higher, said, "My God, is it already starting?" Hartmann went back to his desk, picked up his telephone and dialed an extension. He had to cover his left ear with his hand to shut out the noise. A metallic voice at the other end said, "Gott? It's Paul. What's happening? Meet me downstairs." Gott rang off. Hartmann took his hat from the stand. Von Nostitz said mockingly, "Are you going to join up?" "No. Obviously I'm going outside to cheer our gallant Wehrmacht." He hurried along the high, gloomy corridor, down the central staircase and through the double doors. A short flight of steps, blue-carpeted in the centre and flanked by a pair of stone sphinxes, led to the entrance hall. To Hartmann's surprise, the lobby was deserted, even though the air itself seemed to be vibrating with the noise from outside. Kott joined him a minute later, his briefcase wedged under his arm.
He had taken off his spectacles and was breathing on the lenses, polishing them on the thick end of his tie. Together they went out into the street. Only a handful of Foreign Ministry staff had gathered on the pavement to watch. Across the road, of course, it was a different story. In the propaganda ministry, they were practically hanging out of the windows. The sky was overcast, yearning to rain. Hartman felt a drop of moisture on his cheek. Cobb took him by the arm, and together they walked in the same direction as the column. A score of red, white and black swastika banners hung motionless above their heads. They gave the grey stone facade of the ministry a festive air. But it was striking how few people were lingering on the street. Nobody was waving or cheering. Mostly they had their heads down, or were staring fixedly ahead. Hartman wondered what had gone wrong. Normally the party stage managed these things much better. Cobb had yet to speak. The Rhinelander was taking quick, nervous steps. About two-thirds of the way down the length of the building, he steered them into an unused entrance. The heavy wooden door was permanently barred. The porch offered privacy from prying eyes. Not that there was much to see, just the head of a foreign minister's private office, a harmless, bespectacled, clerkish figure, and a tall young Legation secrétaire holding an impromptu meeting. Cobb clasped his briefcase to his chest, undid the catch, and drew out a typewritten document. He gave it to Hartman. 6 pages, typed in the extra-large characters the Führer preferred, to spare his far-seeing eyes whenever he had to deal with bureaucratic trivia. It was an account of his meeting that morning with Sir Horace Wilson, written up by the Foreign Ministry's chief interpreter, Dr. Schmidt. Couched in the blandest of official language, Hartman could nevertheless visualize what it described as vividly as if it were a scene in a novel. The obsequious Wilson had congratulated the Führer on the warm reception of his speech at the Sportspalast the previous evening, as if anything else was possible, had thanked him for his kind references to Prime Minister Chamberlain, and at one point had asked the others present, Ribbentrop, together with the Ambassador Henderson and First Secretary Kirkpatrick of the British Embassy, to step out of the room briefly so that he could assure Hitler in private, man to man, that London would continue to put pressure on the Czechs. Schmidt had even recorded his words in his original English, "I will try to make those Czechos sensible." But none of that could disguise the central fact of the encounter, that Wilson had had the temerity to read out a prepared statement declaring that in the event of hostilities, the British would support the French, and had then asked the Führer to repeat back what he had just told him, to be sure there was no misunderstanding. Little wonder Hitler had lost his temper and told Wilson he didn't care what the French or British did, that he had spent billions preparing for war, and if war was what they wanted, then war was what they would get. Hartman thought it was like watching an unarmed passer-by trying to persuade a madman to hand over his gun. "So, it will be war after all." He returned the document to Cobb, who locked it back in his briefcase. "That appears to be the case." Half an hour after the meeting ended, Cobb nodded towards the armoured column, "the Führer ordered this. It's no accident it's driving straight past the British Embassy." The noise of the engines split the warm air. Hartman could taste the dust and the sweetness of the fuel on his tongue. He had to shout over the noise, "Who are they? Where are they from?" "Wisleben's men from the Berlin garrison, heading to the Czech frontier." Behind his back, Hartman clenched his fist. At last, he felt a rush of anticipation. "So, now you must agree there is no alternative, yes? We must act." Cobb nodded slowly. "I feel like I'm going to be sick." Suddenly he put a warning hand on Hartman's arm. A policeman was walking towards them, his truncheon drawn. "Gentlemen, good afternoon. The Führer is on the balcony." He gestured with his truncheon further along the street. His manner was respectful, encouraging. He was not telling them what to do, merely alerting them to an historic opportunity. Cobb said, "Thank you, officer." The two diplomats stepped back into the street. The Reich Chancellery stood next to the Foreign Ministry. Across the road, in Wilhelmplatz, a small crowd was gathered in the broad expanse of the square. This was unquestionably a party claque. Some even wore swastika armbands. From time to time, a ragged shout of "Heil!" went up, and arms were raised in salute. The men in the armoured column swiveled their heads, eyes right, and saluted. Young men, mostly, far younger than Hartmann. He was close enough to see their expressions. Amazement, wonder, pride. Beyond the high black iron railings of the Reich Chancellery was a courtyard. Above the main entrance to the building, a balcony. On the balcony, the unmistakable lone figure. Brown jacket, brown cap, left hand clutching the buckle of his black belt, the right arm occasionally flashing out, robotic in its absolute steadiness, palm flat, fingers extended. He couldn't have been more than 50 meters away. Cord saluted and muttered, "Heil Hitler." Hartmann did the same. Once it was past the Chancellery, the column accelerated south towards Blücherplatz. Hartmann said, "How many people would you say have turned out to watch?" Kord scanned the few groups of spectators. "I'd say no more than 200. "He won't like that." "No, he won't. For once I do believe the regime's made a mistake." The Führer was so flattered by Chamberlain's visits, he let Goebbels tell the media to go to town. The German people thought they were going to get peace. Now they're told they're going to get war after all, and they don't like it. So, when are we going to act? Surely this has to be the time. Oster wants us to meet tonight. A new place. No. 9, Goethestrasse, in Lichterfeld. Lichterfeld. Why does he want us to meet all the way out there? Who knows? Get there as close to 10 as you can. It's going to be a busy evening. Cobb clasped Hartmann's shoulder briefly, then walked away. Hartmann stood for a while longer, his eyes trained on the figure on the balcony. Security was astonishingly light. A couple of policemen at the entrance to the courtyard, 2 SS men on the door. There would be more inside, but even so. Of course, once war was declared, it would be a different matter. Then they would never get anywhere near him. After a couple of more minutes, the figure on the balcony seemed to have had enough. He dropped his arm, peered up and down Wilhelmstrasse like the manager of a theatre appraising the disappointing size of the night's audience, turned his back, and stepped through the curtains into the chancellery. The door closed. Hartmann took off his hat and flattened his thinning hair, then pulled down the brim once more, and walked back, thoughtfully, in the direction of his office. Chapter 3. At 6 p.m. precisely, the tolling of Big Ben carried through the open windows of No. 10. As if on cue, Miss Watson stood, collected her hat and coat, wished Leggett a crisp good evening, and left the office, carrying one of the Prime Minister's red dispatch boxes, filled to the brim with her carefully annotated files. The recall of Parliament for an emergency debate on the Czech crisis had put an end to her leisurely summer. Leggett knew she would now bicycle, as she always did, down Whitehall to the Palace of Westminster, leave her ancient machine in New Place Yard, and walk up a private staircase to the Prime Minister's office, which lay across the corridor behind the Speaker's chair. There she would meet Mr. Chamberlain's parliamentary private secretary, Lord Dunglass, upon whom she had an obvious and unrequited crush, in order to discuss answers for PM's written questions. This was Leggett's chance. He closed the door, sat at his desk, picked up the telephone and called the switchboard. He tried to make his tone casual. "Good evening. Leggett here. Could you please put me through to this number? Victoria 7472. From the instant the meeting with the chiefs of staff had ended until that very moment, Leggett had been fully occupied. Now, at last, he laid his notes down on the desk. Trained since childhood for the gladiatorial combat of the examination hall, school, scholarship, Oxford finals, Foreign Office entrance, he had written on one side of the paper only, to avoid smudging the ink. PM expressed concern at adequacy of home air defence. Quickly, he turned the foolscap sheets over so that the blank side was uppermost. As ordered, he would destroy them, but not quite yet. Something was preventing him. He could not say precisely what. An odd sense of propriety, perhaps. All afternoon, as he had ferried in successive visitors to see the Prime Minister and compiled the documents the PM needed for his speech to Parliament, he had felt himself privy to the real truth. This was the information upon which government policy would be decided. One might almost say nothing else much mattered in comparison. Diplomacy, morality, law, obligation, what did these weigh in the scales against military strength? An RAF squadron, if he remembered correctly, consisted of 20 planes. So, at high altitude, there were only 20 modern fighters with working guns to defend the entire country. Putting you through now, sir. There was a click as if the connection was made, followed by the long double purr of the number ringing. She answered far quicker than he had expected, and brightly. Victoria 7472. Pamela. It's me. Oh. Hello, Hugh. She sounded surprised and possibly also disappointed. He said, Listen, I can't speak for long, so please concentrate on what I'm about to say. I want you to pack a week's worth of clothes and get Brackmans to drive you and the children to your parents right away. But it's 6 o'clock. They'll still be open. Why do we have to go in such a rush? What's happened? Nothing. Nothing yet, anyway. I just want to know you're somewhere safe. It sounds rather panicky. I hate people who panic. He tightened his grip on the receiver. But I'm afraid people are going to panic, darling. He glanced at the door. Someone was walking past. Their footsteps seemed to stop. He lowered his voice, but spoke with greater urgency. By later tonight, it may be very hard to get out of London. You need to go now, while the roads are still clear. She started to object. Don't argue with me, Pamela. Will you just, for once, do something I bloody well ask? There was a pause. She said quietly, And what about you? I have to stay here overnight. I'll try to call you later. I have to go now. You will do this. You promise me? Yes, all right. If you insist. He could hear one of the children in the background. She hushed them. Quiet! I'm talking to your father. And then to him, Do you want me to bring you an overnight bag? No, don't worry. I'll try to slip out at some point. You concentrate on getting out of London. I love you. You do know that. I know. She waited. He knew he ought to say something back, but he couldn't find the words. There was a clatter as she hung up, and then all he could hear was the dial tone. Someone knocked on the door. Just a moment. He folded his notes from the Chiefs of Staff meeting in half, and then in half again, and slipped them into his inside pocket. In the corridor was Wren, the messenger. Leggett wondered if he had been listening, but all he said was, The BBC have arrived. For the first time since the crisis started, there was a large crowd in Downing Street. They had gathered quietly near the photographers on the opposite side of the street to Number 10. What seemed to have attracted their attention most was a large dark green van with the BBC's coat of arms and outside broadcast painted on its sides in gold lettering. It was parked just to the left of the front door. A pair of technicians were feeding cables from the back of the van, across the pavement, and through one of the sash windows. Leggett stood on the doorstep, arguing with the young engineer, whose name was Wood. I'm sorry, but I'm afraid it's just not possible. Why not? Wood wore a V-necked pullover under a brown corduroy suit. Because the Prime Minister will be holding meetings in the Cabinet Room until 7:30. Can't he hold them somewhere else? Don't be absurd. Well, in that case, couldn't we do the broadcast from a different room? No. He wishes to address the British people from the heart of government, and that is the Cabinet Room. Well, look, we're on the air at 8, and it's gone 6 now. What if the equipment fails because we haven't tested it properly? You'll have 30 minutes at the very least, and if I can get you any more time, I shall. He broke off. Behind Wood's shoulder, a black Austin 10 was turning from Whitehall into Downing Street. The driver had switched on the headlamps in the early evening gloom and was edging forward slowly to avoid hitting some of the onlookers who had spilled off the pavement into the road. The newsreel cameraman recognised the passenger before Leggett did. The brilliance of their arc lights briefly blinded him. He raised his hand to shield his eyes. He muttered, Excuse me, to Wood,
and stepped down onto the pavement. As the car drew to a halt, he opened the rear door. Hunched down in his seat, Sir Horace Wilson had an umbrella between his knees and a briefcase cradled on his lap. He gave Leggett a weak smile and slid out of the car. On the step of number 10, he turned for an instant, his expression lugubrious and non-committal. The flashbulbs popped. He scuttled inside, like some nocturnal animal with an allergy to light, ignoring his companion, who was emerging from the other side of the car. He advanced towards Leggett, hand outstretched. "Colonel Mason McFarlane, military attaché, Berlin." The policeman saluted. In the entrance hall, Wilson was already shedding his overcoat and hat. The Prime Minister's special adviser was a slight, almost emaciated figure with a long nose and pendulous ears. Leggett had never found him less than polite, even on occasions slyly charming, the sort of reserved senior colleague he feared might one day unburden himself of confidences one would prefer not to hear. He had made his reputation at the Ministry of Labour, dealing with trade union leaders. The thought that he had come straight from delivering an ultimatum to Adolf Hitler was bizarre. Nevertheless, the Prime Minister considered him indispensable. He placed his rolled umbrella carefully into the stand next to his master's and turned to Leggett.
"Where's the PM?"
"He's in his study, Sir Horace, working on his broadcast for tonight. Everyone else is in the Cabinet room." Wilson set off confidently towards the back of the building. He beckoned to Mason McFarlane to follow him. "I want you to brief the PM as soon as possible," he said, and added over his shoulder to Leggett, "Would you be kind enough to tell the PM I'm back?" He threw open the doors to the Cabinet room and marched in. Leggett had a glimpse of dark suits and gold braid, of strained faces and of coiling blue clouds of cigarette smoke suspended in the dusky light, and then the door was closed again. He walked down the corridor, past Cleveley's office and Sire's and his own, to the main staircase. He ascended, past black-and-white etchings and photographs of every Prime Minister since Walpole. By the time he reached the landing, the house had metamorphosed from Gentlemen's Club into a grand country house, mysteriously deposited in central London, with sofas and oil paintings and high Georgian sash windows. The vista of empty reception rooms was quiet and deserted. Beneath the thick carpet, the floorboards creaked. He felt like an intruder. He knocked lightly on the door to the Prime Minister's study. A familiar voice said, "Come." The room was large and light. The Prime Minister was sitting with his back to the window, bent over his desk, writing with his right hand, a cigar burning in his left. An array of pens and pencils and inkpots stood on a little rack in front of him, alongside a pipe and a tobacco jar. Apart from these, and his ashtray and a leather-bound blotter, the big desk was bare. Leggett had never seen a man look lonelier. "Sir Horace Wilson has returned, Prime Minister. He's waiting to see you downstairs." As usual, Chamberlain did not look up.
"Thank you. Would you mind holding on for a moment?"
He paused to suck on his cigar, and then continued to write. Wreaths of smoke hung around his grey head. Leggett stepped over the threshold. In 4 months he had never had a proper conversation with the Prime Minister. On several occasions, minutes he had submitted overnight had come back the following morning with expressions of gratitude written in the margins in red ink. A first-rate analysis. Clearly worked out and well expressed. Thank you, N.C. And he had found himself more touched by these schoolmasterly words of praise than by any amount of the usual politician's bonhomie. But he had never been addressed by name, not even by his surname, as Sire's usually was, let alone by his Christian name, which was a distinction reserved for Cleverly alone. The minutes passed. Surreptitiously, Leggett took out his watch and checked it. Eventually the PM finished writing. He replaced his pen in the rack, balanced his cigar on the edge of the ashtray, and gathered together the sheets of paper. He squared them and held them up.
"Would you be so good as to have these typed?"
"Of course." Leggett walked over and took the pages. There were about a dozen.
"You're an Oxford man, I suppose?"
"Yes, Prime Minister."
"You have a turn of phrase, I've noticed. Perhaps you would read it through. If you find there are passages that need amplifying, feel free to make suggestions. I have so much else on my mind. I worry that somehow it does not flow."
He pushed back his chair
retrieved his cigar, and stood. The sudden movement seemed to make him dizzy. He placed his hand on the desk to steady himself, then headed for the door. On the landing, Mrs. Chamberlain was waiting. She looked as if she had already dressed for dinner, in some sort of velvety gown. She was a decade younger than the Prime Minister, kind, vague.